Good morning, and thank you for the introduction. It's a great pleasure that I join you here today. This is my third APHA conference with the Occupational Health Section, and it amazes me how much I learn each time I come. So I was asked to give a background from a legal perspective on what laws there are that protect workers at the state and federal level. And I was working on the presentation, the title was Workers in Nanotechnology, and I started thinking about that, and I realized that the applications are so widespread now in terms of workplace settings that it's not the phrase can be construed in several different ways. There are laboratory settings, manufacturing, energy production, consumer products, medical and dental applications, which are in some ways being treated very specially in terms of the regulatory process, food production, and I ran across a reference to the impacting agriculture of nano-contaminated soils, and the particular study was looking at how that affected soybean plants, but it really has to raise the question of how will it affect the people who are working in the fields. So my conclusion as I got into this more is that the field, as other speakers have said, is moving from the merely pervasive to the ubiquitous, and I was privileged to read a paper that's in the draft stage now, and the authors pointed out that it's estimated by 2014 nanotechnology-enabled products will be worth $2.9 trillion, or 15% of the global market, and will impact $2.9 trillion worth of other products. So let's take a look at what federal and California laws protect workers, how are they applied, what results, and is there a need for new laws or regulations. At the federal level, there's the Federal OSHA Act, and as you all know, it's the employer's duty to provide employment and a place of employment that's free from recognized hazards that are causing or likely to cause death or serious physical harm to the employee. And that burden is a long-standing one, and it's similar at the state level. And essentially, a little primer for those of you who may not understand the structure of the law, but once the federal law was passed, it occupied the field in the buzzwords of the legal theory, and the OSHA Act of 1970 actually provided for state plans. California is a state plan in which the federal government assesses the plan, the law, the structure of the program, and determines that an effective plan can be operated by the state. California actually had a long history of working on workplace health and safety matters and passed the threshold that was needed. So the rule that we have to meet is that our standards and our program in its operation is at least as effective as the comparable federal program. The structure in California is there is the Division of Occupational Safety and Health within the Labor Agency, which also at a lower level includes the department. So we've got Labor Agency, Department of Industrial Relations, which is like handles wages, hours, working conditions, apprenticeship, data collection, and workers' compensation and occupational safety and health. CalOSHA contains the enforcement and consultation parts of the program and a research and standards unit. There is a semi-autonomous body, the CalOSHA or the Occupational Safety and Health Standards Board, which adopts regulatory standards, and then the adjudicatory arm is the appeals board. So under the federal system, the law either will appear in specific regulations addressing hazardous exposure to hazardous substances, or in talking to people in the federal program, citations and enforcement action can be taken under the general duty clause. There were not many references or any that I could find to specific standards for nanomaterials that people may be exposed to at work, although NIOSH, and I think a previous speaker made reference to this, has identified and issued a paper on the recognized exposure limit for titanium oxide, as is shown on this slide. In the California system, going back a minute to the structure, the division's research and standards unit holds public advisory committee meetings on proposals for things that should be adopted, and it has specific regulatory responsibility for analyzing and evaluating the impact of new federal standards, as well as maintaining a liaison with NIOSH and determining the need for standards where a particular exposure hazard has not already been addressed at the state or federal level. A quick way that the law allows us in California to adopt a federal standard if we are satisfied with it is called the Horcher process. Quite often, though, California has adopted more protective standards than exist at the federal level. Another interesting source of law that was adopted in 1980 and is simple and elegant in its provisions is the Hazardous Substances Information and Training Act. And I'm going to come back to that in a minute. And then the other main focal point in California for work on hazards from nano substances and materials is being done in another agency, the Department of Toxic Substances Control, which includes the state-level EPA, Air Resources Board, Department of Pesticide Regulation, State Water Resources Control Board, and the Office of Environmental and Health Hazard Assessment. So what does Cal/OSHA do in terms of exposures to nanomaterials in the workplace? Our experience so far has been to use existing standards. So, for example, we've had inspections at workplaces in 2008 and 2010, and the kinds of standards that we cited were Section 3204 of Title VIII of our regulations for failure to properly advise employees of the existence, location, and access to information about the toxic substances and harmful physical agents that they were working with, the respiratory protection standard, particularly with an emphasis on proper face seal. The consultation program also has met with an employer engaged in manufacturing with nanomaterials and identified what would be violations if the enforcement side of the program had been at the workplace for not having a written illness and injury prevention program that really was based on a hazard analysis that looked at the materials that were being used by employees in the workplace, had a systematic way for identifying those hazards, addressed what kind of accident investigations needed to be conducted and how to correct unsafe conditions, as well as an ongoing employee and supervisor training program. And in addition, in that particular case, they addressed a standard that deals with a risk management program for carbon nanotubes and nanoparticles. Other standards that California can use, there's a general standard for the employer's responsibility for controlling harmful exposures. So that's on the Cal/OSHA side. Now going over to the environmental side, the background in California is a piece of legislation that was a voter initiative, Prop 65, the Safe Drinking Water Toxic Enforcement Act, which was adopted into the California Health and Safety Code and established the Department of Toxic Substances Control, the requirement that the governor adopt a list of hazardous substances and involved generating a fund for research and carrying out the program, as well as certain enforcement mechanisms. The OEHA played the role of addressing the technical aspects of hazard assessment. In 2006, the California BioMentoring Program was started as a collaboration between the Department of Public Health, OEHA, and the Department of Toxic Substances Control. And more recently, California's embarked on something called the Green Chemistry Initiative, which is in the loosest terms, public-private partnership involved in identifying, evaluating, assessing, and then trying to identify alternatives for hazardous chemicals of concern in consumer products in order to try and limit exposure or reduce the hazard posed. And in this process, the OEHA is responsible for establishing a toxic information clearinghouse, although the regulatory process has delayed that quite a bit. In the process of trying to carry out these mandates, the California Chamber of Commerce brought a suit against the then governor, which is now named California Chamber of Commerce versus Brown. And in that suit, essentially, the Chamber of Commerce was saying, wait, you don't need to do all these assessments. You don't need to you know, draw from all these resources. Really, that piece of legislation said only focus on this process the first time you make up the list, and then use other processes that DTSC has developed to update the list. The Court of Appeal wasn't quite so persuaded, and interestingly, developed an analysis based on referring back to the interplay between the California Health and Safety Code, which refers to different methods listing substances on the list. And one of the methods is called the Labor Code method. And by that, what they were referring to was the Hazardous Substances Information Act, which provides in the Labor Code that if a substance, a chemical, is listed by IARC or is part of the Federal Hazard Communication Standard, that it will automatically be included in the list that OEHA is establishing for toxic chemicals. There are three other methods. The court essentially said that the Prop 65 list can and must be updated by OEHA using the Labor Code method. Where does that bring us? Well, at this point in California, OEHA is moving along at a faster pace than the occupational safety and health agencies in the state. The standards board here is in the process of updating our regs to be consistent with the federal regs that have adopted the globally harmonized system for regulating various chemicals. But there are a lot of limitations in the existing regulatory framework. The enforcement data systems don't identify cases or employers involving nanoscale exposures and materials. So whether we're looking at California data or federal data, we kind of rely on the memories of the inspectors, the field inspectors, in terms of who's out there using nanomaterials. The SIC codes can be in any industry. They don't really identify that the work site involves nanomaterials. There is little dissemination of OSHA information to employers using the substances except whatever they receive from suppliers and manufacturers. And as one of the other speakers pointed out, making that data relevant and usable to employers who particularly are you know, secondary users is a challenge. Medical monitoring, there's a need to identify the workplaces with the exposures in order to track employee exposure and disease. There's poor planning and shared vision, lack of shared vision among the agencies regulating environmental and occupational exposures, although I think in California we're starting to move in the right direction. Lack of worksite hazard evaluation and employee training, and emphasis on emergency action plans. And while many recognize that the adverse outcomes after exposures are similar to substances that have a long history, like asbestos, there is still a need for easily accessible and understandable research that's targeted to nanomaterials. If I were to recommend interim measures for workers, employers, and physicians, they would be the things on this list. I'm running out of time, so I have included some resources that I think would be good resources for employers and workers to understand what is available in terms of data and information on exposure to nanomaterials. And I need to say that these views are personal and not that of my agency, and to give thanks to the wise industrial hygienists at my office who helped me out with pulling these materials together. Thank you.